Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing the recent escalation in the Sudan crisis. I'm joined by a special guest and a returning guest, Dr. Salah Ben Hamu. Salah is a postdoc associate at the Edward P. Jerigen Center for the Middle East at Rice University in Houston, Texas. His research focuses on the politics of military coup, authoritarian regimes, and democratization with a regional focus on the Middle East and Africa. Salah, it's a pleasure to have you come back again. And I look forward
to be back.
So off the record, we were talking about the crisis in Sudan and how this crisis has remained, I think, since 2023 now. So let's start off. Why is this crisis remained intractable?
So there are a few different reasons as to why this specific conflict seems to be never ending and ongoing. And one of the reasons for that is, perhaps the chief reason for that is, the two folks at the top from the Sudanese armed forces, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and from the Rapid Support Forces side, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, otherwise known as Hamedi. Now, aside from the various commentaries we see, which will link this conflict to the ethnic dynamics in Sudan, or many of like the economic reasons that each player has for wanting to continue the conflict, there's also a personal rivalry between these two individuals. And I made note of this when the conflict first broke out back in 2023, that this conflict was going to necessitate the extermination of one of these individuals or the other if the other side succeeded. So for these two generals, it's very much a situation of life or death. And I think taking that perspective really gives us a more holistic view about what to expect moving forward. When these individuals no longer see a path out of the conflict, a peaceful path out of the conflict that retains their own physical integrity and their own safety, they're less likely to put the guns down. And to the thus far, there has not seemed to be a situation in which either feels like they could do that, neither them nor their immediate constituencies around them.
Let's start off, for those that might know, we've started off with the assumption that all of our audience, we know what's going on. Let's start off with the crisis, the historical, maybe a summary of the historical to where we are right now. Let's just give it like a brief background.
Yeah, so I think one of the most important ways to start off the conversation about what happened in 2023 up until today is to start from the revolution of 2019. So just a really brief summarization. In 2019, the Sudanese population rose up against long-standing dictator Omar al-Bashir and essentially mounted a very powerful, nonviolent, cross-cutting revolution. This revolution sparked a military coup from insiders within Bashir's regime to topple him. So once Bashir was out of the way, the power shifted to the armed forces, as well as the powerful paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces. Now, historically in Sudan, the armed forces have been a pivotal political player. There have been several coups throughout Sudan's history and several military regimes. So this was looking like another iteration of that. The difference is that now you had the Rapid Support Forces, which were formed under al-Bashir's reign as almost like a coup-proofing mechanism against the armed forces. But they had originally also been composed, but they are also composed of the Janjaweed militias, which had committed various atrocities in Darfur in the early 2000s. Now, moving into the transitional period of 2019, initially the armed forces and the rapid support forces, so the military and the rapid support forces, had somewhat of an alliance together, a tacit alliance between themselves against the democratizers, so the popular resistance movements, the political parties that emerged in the aftermath of the Bashir regime. In this context, they sought to impede any efforts to democratize the country. They maintained a whole lot of influence over the transition. And when things seemed to be particularly working against them in 2021, they staged a coup against the civilian element of the transitional government and basically consolidated power amongst themselves. So from that situation, 2021 onwards, we can see that it was a story of SAF, which is the Sudanese Armed Forces, and the RSF holding power. Now, the issue from that is the resistance never stopped after there was the removal of the civilian component of the transitional government. In other words, the same forces that drove Bashir out of power returned to the streets to take power back from the military and from the rapid support forces. What this did, in effect, was kind of laid bare the differences between RSF and SAF. We had seen, leading up to the conflict, RSF try to, specifically Hemedti, which is their leader, try to distance themselves from the actions of SAF in 2021. They had even framed the coup as a mistake. They were trying to find a way out for themselves. Now, if we fast forward to the beginning of 2023, there was a lot of concern amongst the RSF and its constituencies that they would be integrated into the armed forces and thus lose their influence because they would be under the military's control. So rather than let this happen, they attempted to stage a coup in 2023 on April 15th. The coup did not succeed, but rather it spiraled into a broader conflict, which started with fighting in Khartoum and then spiraled into the rest of the country. And that, in a nutshell, is basically how the conflict started. Ever since then, the conflict has now become probably the worst armed conflict in recent memory, with more than 25 million individuals at risk of starvation, thousands displaced, thousands killed, and the conflict does not seem to be coming to an end anytime soon.
We will come to the humanitarian aspect of it and also to the implication it has for or a lesson it might have for the wave of popular protests and uprising across the continent. So it might be a cautionary tale to that. But before then, I think the question to ask is, let's focus on the recent stuff. So we've seen that at one point in the lifeline of the competition and contention between SAF and RSF, we've seen where one of our upper hand and then power shifted. It's been, you know, like cat and rat. But recently, we've seen where RSF has taken control of, I think, Darfur, some place in Darfur, and it's led to accusations of genocide or something like that. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, so you're right to say that this conflict, especially within the last few months, has kind of gone through a ping-pong period in which each side seems to be having the upper hand one way or the other. So back around, I want to say either February, March, or April, most likely April, if I remember correctly, the Sudanese Armed Forces retook most of Khartoum from the RSF, and this was lauded as a big victory for the Sudanese Armed Forces and seen as driving RSF back west. But now the last stronghold that the Sudanese Armed Forces had in the west in Darfur, which is where it should be noted the RSF and the Janjaweed militias that composed this RSF originated. Well, with the recapture of El-Fasher, which is the capital of this area, Darfur, the RSF has now essentially we're essentially moving closer to a situation of de facto partition, in which the West is completely under the control of the RSF, and the rest of the country, mostly the center and north, is under the control of the Sudanese Armed Forces. The issue is, and this is where some of the historical context comes into play, what RSF does to the areas that they control is absolutely horrendous. And there are various atrocities that are ongoing as they hold control of these areas. So in El Fasher, we're hearing reports of genocide, mass killings, systematic use of rape and torture. And this is part, and we can tie this back to some of the conflict in 2004 in Darfur, where they were originally instrumentalized by the Bashir regime to put down an insurgency in Darfur. These are more or less what we consider the Arab militias in those areas. They are the ones that compose mostly of the RSF. And their strategy has long been to exterminate the non-Arab elements that are living in Darfur. So what we're seeing now is that type of strategy and that type of outlook playing out in real time.
And that also kind of like broadens the overall, or that complicates or makes it complex. The kind of like simple explanation you've presented at first between power grab between Hemeti and Abohen. Now we've added the ethnic dimension to it, and then we can then take it into how that relates to other regional countries like Chad and maybe Libya that share similar ethnicity. What is the region that, in terms of this, what is this regional implication of this? Is this more broader than just paragraph?
So there's one thing to be noted, specifically when we talk about the regional dynamic here, is that the RSF's fighters are not all from Sudan, specifically. Like many of their co-ethnics in Chad and parts of Libya also fight within the RSF. And this specifically, and if we read earlier reports of what RSF did when they were in control of Khartoum as well, is they were literally bringing folks who were their fighters either from the West, part of their same ethnic group, or outside from Chad and elsewhere, and repopulating them within the homes as they were emptying out the homes of individuals who already lived in Khartoum and basically placing their fighters there. So there is this almost displacement effort going on. And so if we think about it at a regional level, there are regional factions associated with this, given the ties that each side has to various players within the region. The most important one to me in this context is probably going to be the RSF's ties to its co-ethnics elsewhere in the region.
That's very interesting. And then again, that also ties into how the journeys or how weapons, because again, how are these people armed? Who is arming the RSF? Who is arming SAF?
So there are a variety of different actors across, not only within Africa, but also the Middle East and elsewhere, that contribute to the trading of funds within the conflict in Sudan. And these predate the conflict as well. Like these ties have been longstanding before the fighting in 2023 started. So you'll have some support from the Egyptian side, some from the Gulf, some from elsewhere. And they're all essentially like in various capacities funding the flow of weapons into the country. But again, as I mentioned, this flow had predated the conflict. So they're also drawing on pre-existing reserves that they've had. By the time the conflict started, and a lot of folks, and this is something that's missed by a lot of folks, the RSF was already very close to being, if not surpassing, the fighting capabilities of the Sudanese armed forces. The RSF was already a very powerful paramilitary group that had access to weapons, that had access to its own coercive resources that could challenge the military. That's what also makes this conflict so unique. It's very rare that you'll have these paramilitary groups or coup-proofing agencies that are just as strong as the national military. There are very few cases that come to mind with something like this.
And then again, that also brings to... So, okay, let me ask the question. Speaking of how they started the recent stuff, and looking at the role, how the yearnings of the people for a change, for democracy, has then, you know, the trajectory to where we are right now. And then we've seen similar things. We had this conversation last time when we looked at the case of Madagascar and how, for some way, the military has hijacked that now, in a way. We've seen in Burkina Faso, in the Sahel, and all of this stuff. And we'll see, you know, youth, Gen Z, youth rising everywhere. So how does this picture in that wider event that is happening across the continent. Should we be cautioned? Should it be like a cautionary tale to?
Yeah, so I think there's a few different elements here that are really important to point out for other popular revolutions, specifically the ones that target longstanding autocracies. Mm. The first obvious lesson is going to be that just because when the dust settles after a revolution, just because the former ancien regime or the former elites of that regime have sided with you temporarily, this is a very erstwhile agreement. And this is something that's discussed at length across scholarship, across policy reports of different democratic transitions around the world, is that former elites of previous autocracies, specifically these longstanding ones, might temporarily side with democratizing forces initially as a way to appease them in the short term. But at the end of the day, they'll still be fighting tooth and nail to keep their prerogatives in line. So if at any point the transition seems to be targeting their assets, their physical integrity, things of this nature, they're going to want to veto that transition. The case of Sudan shows us the consequences of what happens when these types of efforts themselves fail. So a lot of commentaries will point to this conflict as like the natural progression of a failed democratic transition. But I kind of take a different approach. I see this as the failure of a counter-revolutionary coalition. So generally speaking, we think of revolutionary coalitions as being very factionalized, very divided, which is natural in the aftermath of any upheaval. Most societies are going to have these types of cross lines and fault lines within them, in which they're going to be divided over many issues, specifically in places where political opposition has been suppressed for so long. But the same holds true for counter-revolutionary forces as well. In other words, the same type of factionalism that can break a revolution can also break a counter-revolution. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Sudan, this is effectively what happened. In previous counter-revolutionary efforts in Sudan, specifically in 1958 and 1989, these are other coup attempts. These are other successful coups that were also counter-revolutionary in nature, seeking to end periods of democratic transitions. These efforts were more cohesive, specifically when it came to armed force. In 1958, it was the senior officer corps that staged the coup, and military was more or less more cohesive at the senior officer level. In 1989, it was mid-ranking officers who had already been quote-unquote Islamicized by the National Islamic Front of the previous regime. So there was a sense of cohesion amongst those coup plotters. Within the case of 2021 onwards, the coup plotters, specifically the RSF and SAF, were fundamentally divided over many different lines, not only the ethnic lines, but even during the period of Omar al-Bashir's regime, they were deliberately pitted against each other to counterbalance the ambitions of each other. In other words, this type of division that was deliberately sowed between them during the 30-year-long dictatorship previously, near about the 10-15 years ago that RSF became a true coup-proofing unit, but nonetheless, the deliberate division that was sown between them in the earlier years was laid bare in this period now. So the factionalism that helped Bashir stay in power is also the factionalism that helped this counter-revolutionary coalition collapse and spiral into civil war. What makes it so dangerous is that both sides had access to weapons and were at a very very similar playing field when it came to fighting capability, or when it comes to fighting capability.
You mentioned Islamist stuff. So in my head, I'm thinking, in comparison to the Sahel, let's say Mali, for instance, and see how JNIM and other Islamists have incorporated or co-opted, or some are just, you know, exploited the grievances of the ethnic group, what's their name now, in northern Mali, and also maybe maybe the Fulanis as well, and then try to use that, exploit that for the stuff. Is there similar stuff in the Sudan crisis?
So in Sudan, the story of the Islamist movements in Sudan are a little bit different. They follow more the trajectory of like the Egyptian and Arab world cases. So Islamism in Sudan has roots in the Muslim Brotherhood from Egypt. which was also a very popular political movement across the Middle East at various points of time. The founder of the Islamist movement in Sudan, Hassan al-Torabi, was very deliberate about making a popular popular political party that would mobilize the masses to have this vision of an Islamist regime. The issue there is they weren't able to gain that popularity that would propel them to power, so they relied on the coercive means of the military in order to take power. To the extent that the Islamist conflict or that the Islamist element has fueled any conflicts in Sudan, many of the conflicts that we saw featured in Darfur had some of this Islamist element. So former disciples, in a sense, of Torabi were fighters in Darfur that followed more his vision once he was ousted from political power in the late 90s. At the same time, much of like the Islamist rhetoric was also very reflected a lot of the biases already of Sudanese society. In other words, the Islamist movement at various points privileged the center rather than the periphery. So because of that, we're going to see more Islamism in the sense of Sudan is more of the status quo rather than the fringe marginal elements. To the extent that it was part of the fringe marginal elements, it was either during periods where the Islamists were not in power, or it was elements that had been excluded from power but were once somewhat in proximity to it.
So let's go back to this, to the Eastern Empire, and look at how in recent times now we've seen some kind of like responses to it. How would you judge the responses and or the several peace treaties or peace deals that they go? How would you respond to that?
So I think as I mentioned in the beginning, one of the reasons why this conflict feels never ending is because regardless of the peace treaties that are borne out, written, and ostensibly supposed to be followed, the reasons why they all fail is because at the end of the day, neither side feels like they have a true way out outside of actually taking control of the country. So while there have been efforts to broker a peace from various sides, the fact that both sides perceive the cost of losing this conflict to be so high, I don't see them actually producing any tangible results. So,
but what is the interest? So let's say, for instance, whereas we have, what is the interest of this party? So I could understand Egypt. I think Egypt supports SAF and all of that, and UAE. We've seen the political economy of it. I wanted you to speak to that for supporting RSF and all of that. The United States, and do they have strategic interests? Because we've also seen that weapons from other countries. Recently in the UK here, the UK government parliament were accused of you know, that some of the weapons from the UK and all of that. So what interests do these people have? Do they have special interests in this conflict?
So there are a variety of interests that are associated with the conflict right now, depending on which side folks will back. There are economic interests, so access to various minerals and gold within Sudan, and different actors such as the RSF have much more of a monopoly over access to these areas. So actors that are more aligned with these interests are going to back RSF. At the same time, within the context of SAF, SAF represents almost the legitimate status quo, as opposed to the RSF, which is seen as more of a rogue element of the government. Because of this, you'll have what I would call more status quo aligned actors, like the United States, like Egypt, prefer to side with SAF. Yeah, exactly. So I think that plays a crucial element to it. The ones that they view as being able to hold some kind of stability, not necessarily a peaceful stability, but a stability of some sort, are the ones that are going to be, like, because SAF is seen as that force, the United States, Egypt, other countries would be more willing to back SAF.
Looking at how South Sudan was created from Sudan, and then looking at how, from what you said, that the way it looks like the conflict is being partitioned and SAF has control of some territory, do you think there might be a case where we're talking about like what's going on? I could see similarities with Israel, Gaza. Could we be talking about some kind of secession of getting another state from, do you think that might be a possibility? An autonomous state where RSF is controlling?
I think that whether we like it or not, that's probably the direction we're heading into, in which there will be, if not formal control, it'll be de facto control by these forces. Hmm. So we're most likely going to have a situation in which the West is controlled by the RSF. The issue, and I'll reiterate, is the issue is what's going to happen within the areas that RSF is going to control specifically. This isn't to absolve SAF of any type of responsibility as well from the territories they hold. But to the RSF, there is a fundamental difference, and it's that this force was literally created to suppress and exterminate the elements that live within the West. So with that in mind, viewing how viewing what secession would look like through that lens paints a very grim picture of what to expect if there is going to be a West Sudan emerge from this conflict. It's not going to solve the violence. It's not going to solve the issues of starvation. These things will likely just be more exacerbated, but they'll be more divvied up because it's going to be the separate countries.
Mm.
And there's also the issue that there's no guarantee, even if there was a partition deal, that such borders would remain that way. It would just move from now being an intrastate war to an interstate war. There would likely be conflict between the two sides continuing well into any post-partition situation.
Mm. But then again, I think that also, the complication also goes on to say, right now we have like more like a vacuum of authority, maybe at the moral level, to intervene in Sudan, looking at the high level of humanitarian crisis or even genocide. What do you think is going to happen? Who has the credibility at this time? Because I've not heard so much from the African Union or the Arab nations or whatever. Who has the moral credibility at this point in time to address these issues?
So at this point, it seems like every single regional and international organization that could be significantly contributing to alleviating the humanitarian crisis in Sudan, for more or less, they've seemed to really pass the buck on it. Mm-hmm. The moral credibility at this point has to center on the Sudanese individuals on the ground. So there are various different organizations on the ground, like also known as like emergency response rooms, mm-hmm. which seek to provide medical assistance, food, shelter to individuals. These are all community homegrown networks. If at this point, not only because the international and regional communities have kind of shirked their responsibilities in Sudan or have not put in as much effort as they could, but also because the fighting has become so dramatic within the context of Sudan that efforts to get aid inside the country and across the country have become so perilous for aid workers that it's fallen onto the Sudanese people themselves to kind of get these types of resources out to each other. The question then becomes, how can these organizations better support the people on the ground who are distributing these types of resources? How can they bolster that? How can they put in more of an effort to really invest in not only the protection of the homegrown networks, but also making sure that they're able to complete their missions? So I think when it comes to the moral credibility, we also have to take a little bit of an alternative view, because given what we've seen so far, the ability to get aid into the country and the ability to distribute aid into the country has become so difficult that it's also hard to just place the blame on political will.
Before I come to the last question, let's focus on that civil society organizations, community-based organizations, all of that, and tie that into that also ties well into what I've been looking at, or what we're currently looking at, which you also involved in it. Is there an alternative? Does Africa, does Sudan itself, is there a question where nobody's going to save you? You need to, you have to like save yourself and find a system that works for you. Is that what this is indicating? And if that's the case, how can these homegrown CSOs do this effectively?
And I think a part of that comes down to recognizing that there's a very robust and vibrant tradition of civil society and community support within Sudan. It's been there since the post-colonial era, like since right after independence. Like it's always had a very vibrant and powerful civil society that operates, even if it's suppressed, even if it faces obstacles like authoritarianism or widespread conflict. Like these types of networks and civil society groups persist. The question is, how can individuals really help these groups get to a position where they can take back control of the country? So it's not like in other cases where you'll have, for instance, like after like in a post-colonial period, you'll have like one long-standing dictatorship that doesn't allow civil society to emerge at all. Like Sudan has had various periods of civil society really flourish and emerge in between all these periods of authoritarianism. And that's what we're seeing here as well. Like even during this period of conflict, there still is this type of vibrant civil society that's still operating, and that's how they are still able to get aid across the country. That's how they are still able to have networks with the diaspora who are also funneling in, who are also like contributing to the distribution of aid on the ground. So the question then becomes, how can we prop up this alternative in the face of these armed actors? And that's where the organizations that should have the type of moral credibility or the capacity should step up, is to really help these forces on the ground come to the forefront.
Interesting. Let's come to the last question and have a more broad outlook and say, well, like every conflict must come to an end, like they say, no matter how. So how does this conflict end? And if it ends, and when it ends, what kind of society or what kind of system do you think will emerge, if you can predict?
So if this is, so making predictions is always difficult when it comes to things like this, and I usually try to avoid them, but if based off the current image we have now, like I've been alluding to in previous answers, like I think partition is probably what's going to happen, which bodes really unfortunate for the types of systems that will emerge after it. I do not see a situation in which, either in the center where Khartoum is located, in the surrounding areas, or in the West, any type of inkling of a democratic system or a stable system will emerge. If things are going on their current trajectory, that then begs the question, how can we get off the current trajectory that we're on? And that, so that's the big thing for me, is how do we move away from the current path that the country is on, and how do we steer it into another direction? Part of it is going to be finding a way out for the individuals who are involved in the conflict. There's also likely a question of what do you do in a post-conflict situation with the fighters that committed atrocities? And there's many instances where there are a variety of answers that are available in other conflicts. I think this conflict is going to be a little bit different just because of the scale of the atrocities that were undertaken, and the scale is unprecedented. Like there are very few conflicts that measure up to what's happened so far. So a lot of this is going to depend on what do we do with the forces that were fighting during the conflict.
Interesting. Well, Salah, it's been a pleasure again to have you come and speak on this recent crisis that has, like you say, been described as one of the world's largest humanitarian crisis so far, and one that hasn't received the kind of attention that it should receive. But we're very grateful for your rich insight, and as usual, you know, thank you, and keep you posted.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I'll be in touch shortly with as I've discussed, and we'll proceed with our other engagements.
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
Yeah, have a great day. Enjoy.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in today. Help me as usual to thank our guests, our returning guest, a very knowledgeable Dr. Salah Benhamou, for his rich insights into this unfortunate and sad crisis. For now, stay blessed and I'll see you shortly.